Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on proposed federal cuts to the environment from Jill Sheridan. Tom Maloney speaks with Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson about her upcoming visit to Canada with Governor Eric Holcomb. And Barbara Broja brings us a feature on how Indiana breweries could be impacted by steel and aluminum tariffs. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. As students across the nation prepare to hold rallies Saturday calling for gun control legislation and safer schools, one man in Valparaiso is holding a rally the same day, calling for the protection of the Second Amendment. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Angiano has more.
Pro-gun advocate Jack Papillo says he feels he doesn't have a voice when it comes to the gun debate, so he's organized a counter rally. Papillo says he's a member of the National Rifle Association, and he commends them for the work they do representing him, but there isn't much engagement on a grassroots level. He says if gun owners don't stand up for their rights to bear arms, restrictions on guns will lead to a slippery slope with individual rights at stake.
I mean, the Second Amendment is important, but individual liberty as a whole is really our argument here. I mean, individual liberty doesn't include just the Second Amendment, but that is an important aspect of it.
Papillo says he's been approached about possibly holding rallies in South Bend and Fort Wayne. The group will meet at Valparaiso City Hall at 11. The previously planned March for Our Lives rally is concluding their march at City Hall after meeting earlier at Valparaiso University. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Angiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. February was largely a positive month for Indiana's employment picture. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on a drop in the unemployment rate and progress in another key economic factor.
The state's unemployment rate improved for the second consecutive month as it went to 3.2%. That's the lowest it's been since December of 2000. Helping that was a 5,200 job surge in the state's private sector, led by the construction industry. And for the first time in 5 months, the state's labor force increased. The labor force is a measure that counts both employed Hoosiers and those actively looking for a job. Growth in the labor force is often viewed as a sign of optimism in the economy. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Community leaders gathered at the State House Tuesday to speak out against proposed federal cuts to environmental protection programs. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the emphasis was on concerns for public health.
President Donald Trump's proposed budget would cut Environmental Protection Agency funding by about 23%. Protest leaders called on Indiana's congressional representatives to oppose the cuts ahead of the approval deadline. State Representative Carrie Hamilton says that would have a direct impact on Hoosier health.
EPA supports work that reduces our children's exposure to carcinogens and neurotoxins. They fund work that helps Hoosiers ensure safe drinking water.
Hamilton says the proposed federal cuts would result in the loss of tens of millions of support to the state. The EPA has identified 52 Superfund cleanup sites in Indiana, past, present, and proposed. Congress is facing a budget deadline Friday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A new Indiana law will require companies that dredge sand along the state's Lake Michigan shoreline to use it to replenish eroded beaches. Governor Eric Holcomb signed the legislation into law on Tuesday. The measure requires companies removing sand from the Port of Indiana and around industrial water intake pipes to deposit it directly onto northwestern Indiana's badly eroded beaches instead of offshore. The Times reports the dredge sand that's deposited offshore may never reach the beach. Democratic State Senator Karen Tallien of Ogden Dunes sponsored the legislation. She thanked Holcomb for signing the measure and says that the northwestern Indiana's beaches are an important asset for the state. Tallien says the legislation will ensure the proper care for our beautiful beaches. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb has signed a bill that allows the widespread sale of cannabis-derived oil. Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney has more.
Cannabidiol, commonly referred to as CBD, is derived from marijuana and hemp and is believed to have therapeutic benefits, but it lacks the stuff that will get you high. Holcomb signed the bill Wednesday. He says, quote, Indiana lawmakers delivered a bill that ensures Hoosiers who benefit from CBD oil can access it, end quote. He says the bill provides much-needed clarity with labeling requirements and limiting to 0.3% the amount of cannabis psychoactive ingredient in CBD products. Last year, lawmakers passed a similar law allowing people with some types of epilepsy to use CBD oil, but confusion over the law led to a state crackdown. The new law takes effect July 1st. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. New tariffs on imported steel and aluminum took effect this week, and experts say Indiana will see both benefits and costs. Keith Belton, the director of the Manufacturing Initiative at Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs, says Indiana is the largest steel-producing state in the nation, and those producers have been losing out to foreign competitors in recent years.
And if this action isn't taken, 25,000 steel workers who work in Indiana, their jobs could be at risk.
But Belton says the tariffs will have a very different impact on the Hoosier companies that use steel and aluminum to manufacture their products. And that means consumers will likely see small price increases.
The price of a car, for example, because it has steel and aluminum in it, could be expected to rise by as much as 1%. As a result of these tariffs, and the price of, say, a can of soup could be expected to rise less than a penny.
Belton says the increases will be so small, consumers likely won't even notice them. The tariffs will remain in effect indefinitely. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. $60 billion in tariffs on Chinese imports that President Donald Trump announced Thursday could have a significant impact on Hoosier farmers. As IPBS's Brock Turner reports, farmers worry the actions could impact soybean prices.
Hoosier farmers produce one-third of all U.S. soybeans, and over half are exported. A Chinese state-run tabloid singled out American soybeans as a potential target for retaliation in response to President Trump's tariffs. Melanie Fitzpatrick is the Senior Director of Communications for the Indiana Soybean Alliance and the Indiana Corn Growers. She says if China retaliates with a tariff on American soybeans, people there will be less likely to buy them.
These latest measures by the administration further exacerbate and multiply the concerns of Hoosier farmers from the steel and aluminum tariffs. And they really concern us in terms of making the economic situation of Hoosier farmers and rural communities even more uncertain.
Fitzpatrick says if China moves forward with soybean tariffs, already low prices would drop even further. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brock Turner.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. President Trump's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum go into effect today, and they could negatively impact a growing industry in Indiana. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Rozier reports, craft brewers are preparing for increased production costs.
When you walk into the tap room at Sun King Brewing in Indianapolis, one of the first things you notice is the noise. There's the constant hum of brewing equipment in the background, and some of it comes from the nearby canning line. An automatic belt twists and turns cans through the room as they're sanitized, filled, sealed, and packaged.
Last year, we produced the equivalent of 30,000 barrels worth of beer, which is 60,000 kegs of beer, and a little over 50% of it went into aluminum cans.
Clay Robinson is a co-founder and owner of Sun King, which is one of the largest breweries in Indiana. He decided to can beer long before it became popular across the industry.
We were actually the 53rd canning craft brewery in America. And since that time, it's grown to upwards of 600 or 700 canning breweries.
Canning beer is more economical for most breweries. The cans protect the beer from sunlight and oxygen and are lighter to transport. But costs for breweries who package their beer in cans will likely go up with the introduction of a 10% tariff on most imported aluminum. The Brewers Association says 98% of can aluminum is produced and made into cans in the U.S., but they worry the tariffs could incentivize an overall rise in aluminum prices. Robinson says he isn't sure how much of a hit Sun King will take.
We have a contract on our aluminum for the entire year of 2018, so we won't see any major impact on it until the beginning of next year, but that'll be something that once it goes into place and we find out what it's really going to do to the cost of aluminum, that we'll have to figure out what that does to the overall cost of beer.
Smaller Indiana breweries like Taxman Brewing in Bargersville are more likely to feel the immediate impact of the tariffs. About half of the beer Taxman produces every year is canned. The brewery's suppliers encourage them to stockpile as many cans as possible at the current price to temporarily avoid increased costs. But Chief Production Officer Colin McCloy says they don't have the storage space to do that.
Cans are always funny because you have to, when getting printed cans, order a truckload, which is 25 pallets of 8,169 cans each.
McCloy says it's too early to tell just how much more they'll have to pay for cans. But he says it's an increased cost they'll have to figure out how to make up.
There is a possibility that our prices would have to reflect it. That's going to be a last resort. Obviously, we want to make it as accessible as possible.
Keith Belton is director of the Manufacturing Initiative at Indiana University. He says it's likely a lot of industries, not just breweries, will have to pass on the increased costs to consumers, and it could happen soon.
I would say that you will see price increases from producers to their customers starting pretty immediately after March 23rd, if not already in anticipation of March 23rd.
But here's the silver lining. Belton says the price increase could be so minimal on something like a can of beer that you might not even notice.
The price of a car, for example, because it has steel and aluminum in it, could be expected to rise by as much as 1% as a result of these tariffs. And the price of, say, a can of soup could be expected to rise less than a penny.
With even some of Indiana's smaller brewers on track to can more than a million beers this year, even a slight increase will add up to a significant cost. And Robinson says at Sun King, it's more than just cans they're worried about.
Aluminum cans are in people's hands every day, so it's a really easy thing to talk about. But the back end of our industry is run by stainless steel. So any increase in the price of materials definitely affects people's ability to grow their businesses.
With the tariffs in effect indefinitely, those are costs that will add up significantly over time. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson joined Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney to discuss her upcoming trade mission to Canada with Governor Eric Holcomb. Mayor Freeman Wilson also discusses business expansion for the Hoosier State, as well as what's next for Gary following the city's Amazon HQ2 bid.
Mayor Freeman Wilson, what's the overall goal of the trip to Canada coming up on March 28th?
The overall goal of our trade mission trip to Canada is really to meet with government officials, meet with local businesses. The state of Indiana has a trade surplus with Canada. There are a number of Canadian companies, specifically Canadian National Railroad is one of them, with large operations in the state of Indiana. We actually host CN in our city. So we're going to talk to them about expansion opportunities for existing businesses here in the state of Indiana, but also new opportunities with new businesses who may have an interest in coming into the state of Indiana.
Mayor, are there other organizations like Canadian National that are coming in or out of Canada that are currently based in Gary?
There really isn't necessarily another company, but there are types of companies that we believe would be conducive to have operations in the state of Indiana. You know, Canada is a large steel producer. Obviously, so is the city of Gary with U.S. Steel. But also, there are finishers that would be a great match or fit for the city of Gary. Logistics companies would be an awesome match for the city of Gary. The important part for Indiana generally is that we're at the crossroads of America, but the most important aspect for Gary is that we're at the population center of North America. So if you look at Canada, Mexico, the United States, this is the population center of all of that.
President Trump is calling for 25% increases on tariffs for foreign-made steel, what kind of an impact is that going to have for the city of Gary?
Well, certainly, when you look at the tariffs as a benefit to the steel industry, U.S. Steel's flagship is in Gary, Indiana. That is a positive all day long. You know, so we are certainly optimistic about that aspect of the tariffs. We're also cautious about the fact that when you have tariffs on, it impacts other manufacturers. And so to the extent that manufacturers also get their goods, their steel goods from other manufacturers of steel outside of the country, then that could be a challenge, particularly those who get them from Canada or Mexico, even though we know that those two countries are exempt from the tariffs.
Gary fell short in its bid for Amazon HQ2. What have you seen as sort of the bounce back for the city of Gary? Is there anything coming to the Steel City as a result of its efforts to go ahead and land HQ2?
We've seen tremendous success. It's that we've had success in conjunction with the Amazon bid from Chicago. Many people don't know that the Gary Airport, was a part of Chicago's submission. So we thought we had a couple of bites at the apple, either through our own and certainly through Chicago's. So that's still alive and well. The other aspect, though, is because we were able to really highlight our logistics benefits, our logistics advantages, our trucks, our highways, the fact that we have an airport that is ripe for greater development and that we are on a waterway, all of those things are positives. And companies have reached out to us because it was something that they had never considered. I think that the fact that I'm on this trade mission, the only mayor on this trade mission with the governor, is a positive that resulted from the fact that he was impressed with our Amazon submission.
And Mayor Freeman Wilson, one last question. What are the plans for the city of Gary for the Buffington Harbor?
Buffington Harbor is an absolute jewel for us in that it can accommodate barge traffic. It can accommodate other opportunities. And because of the recent demolition of the Dean Mitchell Power Plant, it is certainly viable for us in Gary and in Northwest Indiana. I think that when the Ports of Indiana was talking about it not being viable, they were looking more at for the deep water solution, the deep water option. There are other options separate and apart from that. The other positive aspects, when we decided to activate the Port Commission, it wasn't about water. It was really about using the port as a development opportunity, as the state statute will allow us to do. So we believe that our port play is a very, very good economic development opportunity, and we're seeing that already come to pass as folks have looked at the potential to factor that into their location decision.
Thank you so much, Mayor Freeman Wilson, for updating us on the business aspects and growth for the Steel City. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Tom Maloney.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Carl Lissick, host of Green Fleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, talking with Terry Butler, Director of Transportation for the School City of Hammond. You can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org as well as on NPR One. Search for WLPR.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And today our guest is Mr. Terry Butler. He's the Director of Transportation for the School City of Hammond. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Terry, I just want to say congratulations being named the South Shore Clean Cities 2017 NERPC Green Fleet Member of the Year at our annual awards meeting in last month. So congratulations to you and the city.
I appreciate that. It came as a surprise because there's so many other groups that are much larger than us that are also doing an excellent job.
Well, and again, I think, you know, we've worked with you and many others from the School City of Hammond on numerous things, and it's a lot of little things, Terry. And I think that's the thing that we like to say is that you know, working with you, it's been a wonderful experience. So I know the School City of Hammond has a large transportation system. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how students about the students in your department services?
Sure. We've got Hammond has over 13,000 students. We transport about 4,000 general ed students and another 650 special needs students, which is our biggest time issue is the special needs students.
I see. And so can you talk a little bit about some of the things that you had done to earn the NERPC Green Fleet Member of the Year Award?
Well, this the big project that we did recently was to install preheaters on the buses through the help of South Shore Clean Cities so that we can, instead of using fuel in the bus running for an hour to try to warm up, they can use the preheaters so when the drivers come in, it's already been heated up. It doesn't run the engine, but it uses about an eighth of a gallon of fuel per hour rather than 2 gallons an hour. And that the side benefits are it also heats up the interior of the bus somewhat.
Sure, sure. So how have the SBAR heaters helped School City of Hammond reduce emissions and save fuel and save money?
Well, as I said, it uses an eighth of a gallon for the idling issues. The students get on the bus, and the bus is already preheated. The drivers come in. They actually can come in 10 minutes later than they used to come in, so it saves a labor cost. But the windows are actually defrosting when they come in, so we don't lose that time, and it's much safer.
Sure. So I hear you're saving on energy costs by using the heaters as well. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was something that we hadn't even thought about. Normally, these are diesel engines. We plug them in with a block heater so that they'll start the next day. With the SBAR heaters, because they do preheat the engine, we don't have to plug them in anymore. And that's roughly 70 to 80 buses that are drawing 13 amps per hour savings. So, and that was around the clock. They'd start as soon as they came in the afternoon. They'd be plugged in until they go out the next morning. So it's been a tremendous savings on electricity.
So in addition to the heaters, you've also changed some routes to help reduce idling and emissions.
We have. We've got a electronic routing program that takes out all the unnecessary expenses of buses going places they don't need to. It sets the routes up so they're the most efficient. We do one thing in Hammond. We insist on right-hand pickup so that kids aren't crossing streets. So that does change it a little bit, but the program does it. We have many, many changes daily with special needs. We average about 25 changes to the routes a day because of adjusted schedules and moving and such. So the routing program takes care of that. We don't have to sit and idle for long periods of time, so it's really helped as far as.
So what would you say to another school district that might be considering implementing an idle reduction program?
Well, not only is it good for the environment, it's good for the students too. A bus sitting and idling, it's still polluting. It still has some, even though the engines are much cleaner now than they were years ago, there's still a certain risk that you're taking. It saves fuel, cleans the air, keeps everybody happy.
Sure. And so then how can people learn more about some of the things that School City is doing with your different programs and things?
They're free to call me at any time. I'm listed on the school website, School City of Hammond. I can give them any information that we have done. I would mention, too, in the past, a number of years ago, a previous director was involved with using the what they called at the time, the bean oil fuel.
Sure.
And so we did do that, which made a difference, low sulfur fuel. I've been there for 27 years, and years ago there would be a haze when the buses all started up in the morning, and if you walked in it, your eyes burned. We don't have those issues anymore.
That's wonderful. And so what are some of the future plans for the School City of Hammond with your transportation services?
Well, depending on funding, because we're property tax-based, I personally and a large group of the people in the school city would like to start moving to alternative fuel, propane. We understand that it's doing very well. One of our neighboring districts was able to do some, and it has worked out very well for them. So that would probably be the next thing is looking at the propane.
Wonderful. And I know as we've talked before on this program with the Volkswagen mitigation plan that our state is going to be getting over $41 million of money for diesel emission reductions. And being in non-attainment areas here in Lake and Porter County, you know, working with you and other school corporations on really trying to take advantage uses some of this money to assist some of our school corporations to reduce what is called NOx emissions. You know, we're hopefully going to be doing that. So it's an exciting time for all of us to help with that plan. So, you know, Terry, I know you're involved with a lot of different organizations with school transportation. Tell our listeners a little bit about some of the other groups that, you know, with school transportation that you work on in our state.
Well, I have a seat on the, in fact, I have to go tomorrow, but I have a seat on the IDOE school transportation board that makes decisions on equipment on buses and modifications to buses. I'm involved with a committee trying to, as you said, the Volkswagen mitigation money, a statewide group there that we're trying to make sure that the voice of the school industry is heard. So those are the two big ones, other than the fact that I also sit on a school board at another district.
Sure. And again, I know that you've been very philanthropic in a majority of your whole career. I know you've been involved with a lot of different things. And again, you know, I just want to say congratulations on all the great things that you do for the school city, but also here for our state. And, you know, again, thank you. And any closing thoughts?
Keep helping us as well as you do, because we all need it. And as I said, schools are taxed right now because of the property taxes, and that's our funding other than students. The students are funded by the general fund, which comes from the state, but everything else comes from property tax.
Well, and it's all about working together, and that's one of the things that we're proud of, working with wonderful folks like yourself, Terry. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Terry Butler, Director of Transportation for the School City of Hammond. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. John Kane, host of Eye on the Arts, talks with Jeff Brown about Valpo University's Jazz Fest. You can hear Eye on the Arts every Monday here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts of Eye on the Arts are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org as well as on NPR One. Search for WLPR.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts to promote the 33rd annual Valparaiso University Jazz Festival is Jeff Brown.
How you doing, John?
Good. Jeff Brown is the founder of the Jazz Festival. Jeff, you've retired, haven't you?
No, not yet. Oh, I've got a few more years left. And
I was going to say, you're like my age. You're way too young to retire.
Of course. But I started the festival back when I had hair, John.
Yes.
And now I've joined the club.
The club. It's so chic. We're the cool kids. So it's too bad our radio listeners can't see how cool we look. So the 33rd annual festival starts on April 2nd. It's five nights.
Five nights, and it's got a few new twists to it. And we're starting out with high school bands, as we have in the past, and they'll be from Chesterton and Portage and Hobart and Kankakee Valley and indeed Valparaiso. And they each come in and prepared with a 20 to 22 minute set. And so, and some of them have been at the festival now for like over 25 years. So it's been fun to see those programs grow.
It's amazing that these programs, maybe it's just coincidental or it's because I'm in the arts, but I know so many people whose kids are going into pursuing education and becoming a professional jazz musician.
It's a tribute to these accelerated jazz education programs that are in this area especially. I think Lake and Porter County and some LaPorte County have some of the finer jazz educators in the state, and it's them.
Well, I think the parents are somewhat mystified, but they're also good about supporting. I mean, these are like our board members and so forth. So these are people who are in the healthcare professions and in the law professions. So, you know, they're not as concerned about what money their kids are going to make maybe. And that is a luxury for them to be able to let their kids go to expensive schools.
And in many ways, that's one of the important aspects of jazz education and music education in general, because not everybody can be a great performer, not everybody could be, but you do have people that are learning about this music that become great supporters of the music, and that's equally as profound.
That's fantastic. So, okay, high school starts, and then what happens?
Then on Tuesday, April 3rd, we have the second version of the swing and dance night, which is a which is a concert in association with the Valparaiso Concert Association. And it's one that we play a lot of standards, like In the Mood and a lot of Frank Sinatra-ish types of things. And things that folks, that we encourage folks to dance.
It's
a very interesting evening like
That's
that.
Nice.
Then on Wednesday night, we have some more high school bands. Then the University Faculty Jazz Trio, which I'm in as well.
Yes.
And which you've heard many times.
Many times.
And we'll be performing with Don Braden. Don Braden is a phenomenal jazz tenor saxophonist from the New Hampshire area. And he's recorded extensively worldwide. He'll be there. And then they're a very interesting group that makes its maybe like 10th appearance at the festival over these 30-plus years. It's the Northwest Indiana Jazz Educators Big Band. And essentially what that is band directors who still kind of have maintained their chops throughout the years. And we get together, we do one rehearsal, and then we do a concert. And it's a lot of fun. And it's for the amount of rehearsal that that ensemble does, which is like one, we have a great deal of fun. And we do a lot of different repertoire. And it's a lot of area band directors that you see, you know, directing ensembles, actually performing. On Thursday the 5th, the VU Jazz Ensemble will be there. That's the ensemble that I direct at the university. And they'll be performing with Don Braden as well. And we have some commissioned works that will be premiering that evening. We've got some various, very interesting arrangements and compositions of Don's that he performs when he does these types of clinics that you don't necessarily hear on the radio or in other aspects. On Friday night, Bill Boris will be leading off with his trio. Bill's an incredible jazz guitarist here in the United States. Excuse me. He's located. He's a professor at Columbia in Chicago, and his trio is an organ trio. Which is an interesting compilation of musicians to say it's guitar, drums, and organ.
Is this like the Hammond B?
Hammond B3. You're just too hip, John, today. you are just too hip. And
I like the sound. I love that sound.
Yeah, yeah. And then like then Tierney Sutton. Tierney Sutton is an excellent vocalist. She's got, I believe, 9 Grammy nominations. I won't talk politically about the Grammy Awards on this show, but I mean, like, that's a whole other topic. But the thing is, she doesn't have the grand name of other folks. She is absolutely singularly most amazing jazz vocalists I've ever witnessed in my life, and I've seen a great deal of them. Her ability to utilize her voice as an incredible instrument is truly amazing, and it's something that I would strongly encourage people literally of any age that are interested in being a vocalist. You truly need to see how she approaches her instrument, which is her voice.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here, Jeff, to tell us about this jam-packed 5 nights of jazz music at Valparaiso University coming up April 2nd through the 6th. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Noted Indiana economist, speaker, and writer Morton Marcus joins regionally speaking host Chris Nolte to talk about some of his latest Eye on the Pie columns published across the state that cover Hoosier and national economy and related topics. Here's the conversation.
We have a major activity in exporting the goods that we produce. These are manufactured goods that we're talking about only. There's much more that goes into foreign trade, but the column that I wrote deals only with the manufactured side. And Indiana basically has a good balance of trade with Canada because of all the auto parts that we ship to Canada. And we have a very positive situation with Mexico as well. We ship a lot of medications out of the state of Indiana from our pharmaceutical companies. And strangely enough, we've got a negative relationship. That is, we import more than we export. from Ireland. And I think a lot of that is within individual companies mm-hmm. where they have facilities in Ireland and they then ship them back to the home base here in Indiana.
Well, I know that Governor Eric Holcomb is going to be making another trade trip. This time he is going to Canada. In fact, I understand that Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson is going to join the delegation on that trip, which is coming up this next week. So I'm sure that the governor must feel that having her there will certainly give her a little education. Plus, maybe she can make a pitch or two for Northwest Indiana while she's there.
Oh, I think that will be in order, and I think it could be quite successful. Mm-hmm. We do have that excellent position within the United States, and so easy to come across I-94 from Canada, and on the way to the great transportation center that we have in metropolitan Chicago.
Mm-hmm. One of the other columns you did too, I know some of it was a lot of it was really tongue in cheek, but it did talk about some interesting things. You were talking about the correlation between prisons and colleges and how they in a way seem to be related in that they are really a good economic magnet. Tell us about that, please.
Well, you think about Michigan City, and one of its major industries, of course, is the prison there.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just the number of prisoners, but it's the number of workers and other firms that tend to provide services to the prison. We find the same thing with the universities. Our state universities and our private universities draw students from all over the world, and then there's a lot of services that have to be provided to them. And these are forms of export, in a way, export for the individual communities or for the state, in that we're selling services to other places.
We sell
a lot of pizza to those students.
Yes, that's true. And I think people kind of forget that at times, unless you happen to live in a community like Michigan City and it's there, so you know, you see the truck traffic go by and see the impact that the prison, as sprawling as it may be, and certainly not much activity because everything is indoors inside, mm-hmm. May be happening, but it does have a big impact on the local economy, to be sure. So
that's right, and we tend to forget that, and we think about trying to attract other industries. There's a long-standing joke that says that when the state was considering establishing its various universities, that at the same time they were thinking of developing mental institutions, mm-hmm. and Logansport picked the mental institution, Bloomington picked the university, and people in Logansport have been very happy ever since.
One of the other columns that you had in, Morton, was talking about an issue which I know did not get very far in the legislative session that just ended here, was talking about townships and consolidation and trying to bring townships together of smaller sizes and to create larger ones. Will you go back through that column and explain what you felt in your way of putting it, brought out the problem about how many townships we have in Indiana?
Well, we have a lot of townships. I think the number is about 1,005 now. It used to be 1,008. But the question is, do we need all these township governments? Some people think about it in terms of saving money. I don't think of it in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real question is, could we provide better services for people? And none of the discussion that I've seen really focuses on that aspect of it. What is it we expect the township government to do? In some townships, it's the volunteer fire department. In almost every township, there's a certain amount of poor relief that goes on, emergency funding for people who need $100 to pay an electric bill and things of that sort. But we really ought to ask ourselves, what is it that we want the township government to do? It used to be, when we started our state system, that the township provided education. There was the township school. The township was responsible for the roads in the area. And today those functions have been taken over by school districts and taken over by county or state highway departments. We ought to ask ourselves, what is it that we are currently doing with townships, and can it be done better if it's taken over by a larger unit? Or are there other things that should be done that nobody's doing and that could be done best if you were serving small numbers of people?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not against something just because it's large or just because it's small. I think what we ought to say is, what's the best way of providing services to people?
I know you bring up in that column a topic that has it's been a long time, I guess it's been mentioned, but it seems to be coming back, and that's referring to the Kernan Shepherd report, which came out more than a decade ago,
which is an
interesting document in itself. For folks that are not familiar with that, maybe have forgotten about that, refresh our memories and kind of put that in the context of what you mentioned in the column.
Well, the Kernan Shepherd report basically gave us a sort of a blueprint for making improvements in government at all levels. And they were very concerned about the fact that we have so many different governmental units, so many cities and towns, as we see in Lake County and in Porter County as well. Does it really make sense to have all of these governmental units? And it's not a question of saving money. That's how people think about it. But the real issue is, are we going to find that the smaller units of government are much more responsive to the needs of the people? It doesn't mean that the people in Schererville really have much of a difference in their idea of public services from the people in Dyer or the people in St. John or the people in Highland. The issue has to be, how do we provide these services in the best possible fashion? Fire safety is an obvious one, but there are existing relationships now between most of the fire departments, and so if they need a few extra trucks in one community, they easily get them from another community. They help out. They have these working partnerships. Again, it's not a question of money alone, and yet that's how so many people look at it. The thing that troubled me about the Kernan Shepherd report is that it's basically without any supporting evidence.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is on the basis of, well, we think it would be better if. And I just don't think that we ought to go ahead on that basis alone.
So it doesn't.
It's sort of like my feelings about Lake South Shore extension down to Dyer.
Yeah.
I've always felt that there isn't really enough empirical evidence been presented, and that it's being built on the basis that, you know, if you build it, they will come. I don't know who they are.
Yeah. So I guess in a way you think that maybe in some of the aspects in the Kernan Shepherd report might be would be wishful thinking, I suppose.
I believe that it's sort of the general belief that mm-hmm. we would have economies as a result of combining the various units. We have seen situations where units of government have been combined. Indianapolis is one of the great examples of that. But no one's ever been able to write a report showing me that somehow the people in Indianapolis either got better services or that they saved some money. Now, I have seen it with some libraries
mm-hmm.
where the quality of service goes up when you're dealing with a larger library system, and the expenses can actually go down. But that has been demonstrated, but I haven't seen it with many of the other things. It's the same way with schools. We're going to consolidate the schools, and we have consolidated a lot of schools, but we don't go in and do any studies afterwards to see whether it actually fulfills the promise.
We're talking with a noted Indiana economist and writer and Speaker Morton Marcus about his columns.
Troublemaker. That's troublemaker. The word.
There we go. That's probably true too. Gadfly might be another term too. I suppose. Talking about his Eye on the Pie columns that come out on a regular basis around Indiana. One of the other columns I know, Morton, that was very interesting and certainly very local. Talks about potholes and how that might be a good project for the researchers at Purdue University to take up. Tell us about that.
Well, we do have a research unit at Purdue.
Yeah.
That is concerned with road surfaces, and they do a lot of work and have been doing a lot of work for 20 years, but they don't seem to be making a lot of progress. And it isn't just here in Indiana. It's also true all across the same latitude. It's true in Ohio, and it's true in Illinois and Missouri and Kansas, just straight across I-70, basically. And I-80 is the same way. We have a lot of potholes, in large part because we, particularly in Indiana, don't put the money into building the roads properly in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We may not make the concrete thick enough. We may not put in sufficient amount of asphalt. But there are things that could be done at relatively low cost. I'll tell you my simplest solution that would be very helpful. When I'm driving at night, and particularly if it's raining, it's very hard to see a pothole. And what I would like to see is the city or the state or somebody go around, maybe this is a role for township government, and paint the potholes with the kind of paint that reflects my headlights back.
Not a bad idea. And probably you could probably find a paint that would be economical enough in cost because you'll have to use huge quantities of it sometimes to mark all those potholes, I would imagine. Say the least. Well, Morton, we appreciate you spending time with us today and that we will be checking back in with you again really soon to find out more of the Eye on the Pie columns and your viewpoints. I've been talking with noted Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus and getting an idea on the Eye on the Pie, as he puts it. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.